all things new, new beginning, pick up your life. And I'm going to be reading from John chapter 5. And it's a familiar story to those of you who have been saved for a period of time. Maybe new to some of you. But before I do that, I want to just give just a little introduction and a way of change to tell you kind of how I came to this idea. As of late, you know, every time you learn something, you go to school, you're always kind of caught with a certain idea, or you focus on one particular theme for the year. And lately I've been, it started out like in January or February when I was doing a study on the phrase that Jesus uses in the book of Matthew and the book of Mark, especially Matthew 28:17. It has to do with the Great Commission, where Jesus says, "Go therefore and make disciples." And I was kind of caught up with the word "go therefore." And I think some of you would actually remember that last year I did a series of messages that talked about the "as you go," the things that would happen as we were busy about doing God's work, that there was really power in "as you are going." And it kind of started for me as a study there. And then, if you remember, late in the early part of the summer, I did a series of messages on the chapter of Isaiah. And I talked about his commission, where the question was presented to Isaiah, who would go to the nations? And Isaiah responded with a, "Here I am, Lord, send me." And I talked about the problem that Isaiah had, in that he didn't see himself as worthy or qualified to do much of anything. When he gets in the Lord's presence, he's fairly paralyzed. And I think some of you would recall my unique aspect there, where you know, I believe that this that statement of "who will go" wasn't simply just a general statement. I think the statement was geared towards Isaiah. And if you read how that vision happened, you'll see that Isaiah was summoned into that realm to have that kind of prophetic vision. He was angels were sent to get him, and he was ushered into the Lord's presence. And so he's sitting by the river, kind of contemplative or reflecting on the Lord, and maybe just hanging out. We don't really know. But immediately he's translated, and the scene of heaven changes, and his very first vision is of this holiness of the Lord. And it's the theme of the song that we hear, that the glory of the Lord begins to fill the temple. And Isaiah is pretty well overwhelmed by the holiness of God, and he falls on his face. And I always had a unique aspect, because I tend to look at the Bible in more funny ways. I can always envision that the Lord wants something done, and the time is right. So as it was right to create the earth, he's ready to do something new in the earth. He wants something great to happen. And so he unveils his plan to the universe, to the council of heaven, and it's time, and Isaiah's the man. Go get him, brings him into the Lord's presence, or Isaiah comes into the Lord's presence, and then he gets overwhelmed by the vision and falls on his face and says, "I'm a man of unclean lips," and I can picture him just crumbling in the Lord's presence, as most of us probably would do. And I always kind of joke that if we can only see things through heaven's eyes, you can envision Michael the archangel standing on his second right, and the Christophany of the Lord standing here, and you know, he's got Gabriel, and you know, I always envision Michael being a little sarcastic. I don't know where I get that idea from, but anyway, so Michael the sarcastic archangel looks at the Lord and he says, "Well, that worked exceedingly well. Man of God is now, you know, humble and completely incapacitated to do what God wanted him to do." And so I always had this vision that the Lord had to deal with Isaiah's problem, which is the real story behind the coal coming out of the altar. It was not something the Lord said, "Before you do this, you need this." The Lord obviously summoned Isaiah to see it and wanted him to respond. But it was Isaiah's sense of inadequacy that had to be healed. And so the coal comes off to heal, purify the lips. It's not simply that God wanted a pure messenger to send his message. Had that been the case, there could have been lots of other things. I think that Isaiah's response says everything about God's cure and how he works in our own levels of incapacity to try to bring about a newness, a new way of life. And so I've always looked at Isaiah in that same context, and that was kind of the theme of the message that I did there. And then there was another time earlier in February where I spoke about Abraham, and I talked about the importance or the significance of Abraham being commanded by God to leave his family, and that if anywhere there was a beginning for the step of faith, and if Abraham is applauded for having any faith, then it happened at that moment when God said leave. Because that's the characteristic of every person in faith, is which I'll talk about in a minute, but you'll see that there's something scary about that connection. That there's a, well, I'll just say it this way, there's a disassociation with the former, whatever that is. So Abraham is told, disassociate yourself from your society, your family, everything that's kind of that you've known, everything that's familiar. And our particular texts don't necessarily give the kind of credence to Abraham or the struggle he must have forced as some of the other writings do. Obviously, that particular time period has some other stories about Abraham. And we can see in that particular story that, you know, Abraham really had a lot to lose. He moved away from his family because he knew that he didn't want to worship their gods. That was the reality. His father was obviously into idolatry, and there was lots of stories there that Abraham was turning away from one system to worship the one God. Abraham would have been the first person that saw God as one. And that the birth of what we call monotheism, or the worship of one God, really begins when Abraham says, I will worship the God, God alone. And so you see these, it's kind of weird that I take those three messages. As I was doing a study in those three messages, that I came upon another reading of this particular passage in Matthew chapter 28. And I noticed that the phrasing of the word, go therefore, had a unique rhythm to it. And I was telling Sue yesterday, I'm not much for anagrams, and I don't really like word puzzles, but if I do any kind of puzzle at all, I like those word searches that kind of have the words that go this way and that way and backwards, and you have to find the words. She tried to teach me Sudoku, and I think I can kind of like that if I can ever figure the stupid thing out. But anybody ever played Sudoku? That's like madness in a box, that game. But I like word search puzzles because you can kind of see words in a, you know, in a different context. So, but part when we were kids, anybody take English grammar and ever had to write, what's it called, a haiku? Is that, Emily, you're a grammar person, yeah? Where you have to like make this poem out of seven words. Anybody ever had to do that? Yeah, I said haiku, and Mike's like, I haiku too. You know, that's not, there's other kinds of puzzles and poems where they like are going to try to make the shape of a tree, you know. And so the first word sentence has one word in it, and then it kind of builds to, you have this like picture of a tree. Well, the book of Psalms is written like that. And so you can see patterns in the Bible where they tried to send a similar message just by style of writing, genre. And uniquely, as I was kind of looking at this passage about go therefore, I saw something that I had not seen before. And that is a connection between the go therefore in Matthew chapter 28, the who will go in Isaiah 52, and then the leave, go, command to Abraham in the book of Genesis. And I thought, well, that's weird. I wonder if I'm the only one who sees this. And so after some study, I'm beginning to find out that I'm not unique, that actually there's a lot of people who make a connection between those three phrases, which is really weird because most of us as evangelicals have always understood Matthew 28 as like going and making disciples, and we see it in the context of evangelism. So the immediate thing that comes to our mind is we have to pass out, you know, Bible tracts at Carl's Jr. to the waitress. And anybody ever evangelized like that and felt uncomfortable with doing it, where you take a gospel tract out to a restaurant and you have it in your pocket and you're trying to enjoy your meal, but your heart's racing because you know you have to witness, like, and some people have to take classes on evangelism, and that's part of it. Okay, you're going to go and you're going to witness, and it makes you feel, you know, I know for me it's kind of like I'm trying to look for the one opportune time to give the waitress the tract, you know. I used to be a waiter, and one of the things I hate is when people would give me gospel tracts instead of a tip, you know, so they would kind of like, you know, we love you in Jesus, thanks a whole lot, you know, throw it on the ground. But there's a, you always see Matthew chapter 28 in the ideas of go. But when you look at the story itself about this, the whole picture of Matthew 28, you begin to see that we're talking about an ascended Jesus who's talking to his precious disciples. and there is something that is changing. He's about ready to ascend, and he's about ready to leave, which is really a weird thing too. Don't you think it's kind of anticlimactic? You know, it's kind of like, you know, Jesus ascends, and it would have been nice if they had a parade, and that would have been good if the Jerusalem March had been there. You know, where they carried him on his shoulders, and you know, like Gladiator, he would have been the hero or something. You know, flowers coming in. I don't know, but it does seem kind of anticlimactic. I always thought it was kind of humorous of. Because my picture, again, is always a little sarcastic, but you can see Jesus saying, you know, in this life you're going to have tribulation and blah, 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 and here it goes, and da-da-da-da, and I'm being taken to heaven, and hang on. And I always thought of that scene in The Wizard of Oz where the wizard's getting in the balloon, and everybody's all panicked about what their life will be, and he's like, bye, and he floats away, you know. And yet that really isn't what is taking place. We obviously know that he's leaving so the Holy Spirit's comfort can happen. So what in the world does that go therefore have to do with my connection to a new beginning in John chapter 5? Well, I noticed that the idea of go therefore and who will go and the statement to Abraham go represents a theme of a new beginning. And that's really the challenge of Matthew chapter 28. The former system is gone and there is now a new beginning. And where you once were fishermen, and where you once were tax collectors, and where you once were whatever it is that you do in your vocation, where all the world that you knew before, that you felt comfortable in, all that represented your life, when you come to Jesus, that changes. Now, when I became a Christian, I did not anticipate how much of my life would change. There's a lot of me that's still there. But but when a person comes to Christ, each one of you in your room know that it's one of perpetual sacrifice. And I don't mean that in a gritting teeth kind of a sacrifice. I mean that every day that you follow Jesus, there's something that's required of us. And that something required of us is something that we willingly trade away in order to get something deeper, something better. But it's always a progression of letting go what was to moving ahead to what will be. Do you see the transition there? And yet there are these key moments. Like what happens when we first get called to the Lord, where not only is it just a decision about what is it that you're going to give up today to move into what's tomorrow, but it's one of those key moments in your life where you recognize that nothing will ever be the same again. And from this point forward, my life is going to be radically different than it was yesterday. For me, that happened the first time I went to a church service, and I had decided that, you know, I wasn't done partying, you know. And I went back and tried to find my place in my old life and in my old world. And can you imagine my surprise when it was no fun anymore? Has anyone tried that at all, to go back to a former thing and just said, well, I'll just try not being this again? I sat in at a meditation class because my family was big in transcendental meditation, and all of whatever I knew by spiritual ascent did not happen anymore. I now had Jesus in my life and the former things were gone. I began to resent how my family was treating me because all of a sudden I began to see myself in a different context. Does that make sense? And anybody ever gone back to a family reunion and you're treated the same way you did when you were 10 or 8? The family system hasn't changed, and so you go back and they keep trying to think about, oh, remember when, remember when, remember when. And just recently I saw that conversation and the guy goes, yeah, when I was 12, you know, when I was 8. But I'm a grown man now and I don't like the same thing. I know somebody, I think it had to do with getting a Christmas present, and somebody bought a toy for this person thinking, oh, he loves whatever toys. And he's like, I loved it when I was 10, you know, not when I'm 30. So there's always that limitation about being able to see yourself on new terms. And that's, again, wrapped up in this whole statement of Matthew 28. When God says, go ye therefore, that go doesn't just mean the Great Commission, doesn't mean evangelism, it also means a brand new beginning. That things will change. And that the former not only is something that needs to be detached from, disassociated from, like in Abraham's case, it's something that's impossible to get back to. Your life will radically change when you know Jesus. Nothing will be the same. Your relationships won't be the same. The way you interact with your family won't be the same. Your workplace won't be the same. Now, in this room, there are people who have had significant calls to ministry. And I would wager to say that, and have had this experience many, many times, and I would wager to say that when you first got saved, you probably thought, well, I'll just serve the Lord and do whatever it was I'm doing by way of vocation. In my particular case, I was a bartender when I first got saved. And like I said, it was at a Christmas potluck when my pastor at that time, Pastor Skip, said, so after I had been at the church a few months, he said, well, what do you do for a living? And, you know, I worked in aerospace a little bit, so I knew one of the guys, but my big job, the job that really paid me the most, was I was a bartender. And I said, well, I'm a bartender. And he's like, a bartender? At which, can you come by and talk to me? And I remember my first response as being a little bit sarcastic, because at that time I didn't know you had to be nice to pastors. So when he said, you can't be a bartender anymore, and I'm like, really? And he says, yes, because, you know, you want, you know, God's good money. And I got into a conversation. I said, so working for aerospace, blowing people up with missiles, is somehow better than serving them liquor. I don't get the relation, but okay. And I remember him saying, well, I just have a problem with people making money off of other people's problems. And I said, well, you didn't have any problems cashing the tithe checks. So I know that there was a little bit of a problem there. But I listened to what he said, and, you know, I couldn't go back into that lifestyle anymore. Once, you know, Ron Archer used to say that you have to obey the truth that you now, or truth that you now possess, and that's a valid point. You know, every time we come into a new awareness of whatever it is, that spirituality, whatever is former, just is no good to us anymore. Does that make sense? Right. So some of you are probably in that point. I know, Max, you're thinking full time. Steve, you've been there a million times. Marty, you too. And, you know, all of us that are in here are thinking about these ministry vocations. Do you remember the time when all of you had the nice plan in your head, this is what I'm going to do, and all of a sudden you realize that I can't do this anymore. I can't do that at all anymore. I'm not called to do that anymore. This is not part of my book. This is not who I am. I will not be defined by this. I cannot be defined by this because I'm not being defined by this. This is God speaking about who I am now, not who I once was. Does that make sense? You guys hearing me out on that? So a defined line. The going therefore represented a new beginning. That the former was gone. And you're hearing constant teaching. This is one of the problems that I have with doing just unique word studies, where you take a word in the Bible and you just look at it and you say, wow, that's what that means. And you can, you know, anybody that does any kind of word studies knows that, you know, you're going deeper and deeper into words. You go where to the Webster's Dictionary and you keep trying to find the meaning on the text. And it's good to do word studies. You get some idea of it. As long as you understand that seeing a passage in the context of what it means for our life, the meaning is much better to know what it is that Jesus is trying to tell us in the passage. What did he mean, go therefore? Because that wasn't just what was spoken to the apostle. That go therefore is for us today, right? And so this is what he's saying. The former is gone. Your former life is gone. What you used to do is gone. And now it represents a new beginning. Today, it starts right here. It starts right now. And whatever it was that was in your past, you have to disassociate yourself from that. It won't work for you anymore. And there's a gravitation to what will be. And they didn't know what was going to happen. I mean, these 12 guys, Jesus, great. There goes Jesus. Now what are we supposed to do? I don't know. He said, wait for the promise. Well, let's go do that. They really didn't have a logical system to it. Whenever I think of that, I came from a Catholic, so I always think that there's this grand order and things are handed down and, you know, little everybody knows what they're supposed to do, and that's kind of how I envision the church. But yet, my reading of the New Testament and my introduction to these 12 guys who ended up revolutionizing the world really reveals to me a guy that really kind of just winged it as they went along. Do I have proof that they winged it? Sure. You know, of all the order, the history, passing down God's leaders and all we can do, this is the most systematic way that these 12 guys can figure out how to pick a new apostles. Do you know what it was? They didn't take applications. They didn't go through the resumes. This is how they did it. It was really a glorified version of, okay, let's play rock, paper, scissors. Okay, well, Matthias, you're in. Bob, you're out. I mean, they drew straws. I mean, to pick the apostles, that's a holy way I'd never saw before. Which, by the way, is the way we pick most leaders for this church. But which is a lot better, because most churches use the, you know, the venerated, dignified tithing record as a way to... Yes, I've heard from the Lord. Oh, I'm going to regret that one. I know already I'm going to get in trouble for that. Oh, that's pretty funny. Oh, I won't even try to retract that. Anyways, you get my point. You get my point, right? So there's a new beginning that's represented in Matthew chapter 28. A new beginning represented in Isaiah 52. A new beginning that's represented in Abraham. And And that's kind of where we're at in John chapter 5. And so finally, without any more ado, we'll move forward to John chapter 5. John chapter 5, I'm going to read with verse 2. Now there is in Jerusalem near the Sheep Gate a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, which is surrounded by five covered colonnades. And here a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, the paralyzed. The one who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a very long time, Jesus asked him, "Do you want to get well?" "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, somebody else goes down ahead of me." And then Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat, and walk." And at once the man was cured, and he picked up his mat, and he walked. I've never been much a forest person, and so I've never been camping, and I have been camping now, but when I first came to know the Lord, I had not done anything rustic like that. So I've never seen like the great wonders of the world, and the only thing I can recall is when I was a kid, at one of the museums, they had a cross-section of one of the redwood trees from the sequoia. Now, when my grandmother died a number of years ago, I was able to see some of these in Big Sur firsthand. I had not seen trees like that. I think trees, and I think like a big tree is like this tree in my backyard, but I've never seen something like a sycamore before. And I remember vividly, like this thing was so huge in this museum that I saw this cross-section of a tree. And I was fascinated by the rings that were on a tree, and I think that I'm being a little bit simplistic to most of you. But I, you know, it was there at 9 years old, seeing the museum things, I learned that the rings of the story could tell you how many years old the tree is by just counting the rings of a tree. And when you look at the thin, there was always they were always a little disproportionate. Like some rings were real thick and other rings were thinner. And the guy who told me at the museum said that the thin rings are sometimes years that weren't so good. That they were like drought years, or there was some kind of thing that had happened, and the shading meant there were different environmental stuff that was going on. That's why you had light and dark that provided the contrast. And even that there were places, like on one side there was like a burnt chunk, and they talked about how that had been a tree that had been hit by lightning or something, and that's what caused the discoloration as the rings had grown out. And I kind of just realized that after a normal years of growth, even in a person's life, the same thing kind of happens, you know. I mean, as we get older, we begin to change. Obviously, I'm still a very pretty man, but there are times when we are growing that we change, you know. There are more lines around our eyes. We're much more candidates for Botox than we are for, you know, steroids. And we grow older, and things about us change. The one thing I always thought was predominant about Jesus, and one of the most moving messages that I can recall in my life, was the message where I learned that Jesus could have been raised from the dead in any condition that he wanted, but that he chose to rise from the grave with the scars, the nails still imprinted in his hands. He still bore the scars. And so I remember that was a very profound message for me, that Jesus rose with scars. And I thought, you know, as I got saved, there's one typical pattern where we all try to kind of look like, everybody else. But those of us that are honest and genuine in the faith recognize that as we grow, we still have a lot of what used to be with us. We still have the hurts and the pains and the things that we experienced in life that continue to follow us even when we're older. And, it's really possible. I realized this just recently in our own Christmas, when we were spending it with our family, that some of the dysfunctions that aren't even relevant anymore. I mean, some of the things that happen to you when you're way, 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 way a child, they still impact you even though you're old. You know, you still have the same, whether it's a wonderful connection, some kind of kind memory that you have about something that took place, or maybe something that's a little bit more bitter, something that hurts a little more. You know, we get defined and paralyzed in those moments way back there. And so you come to this idea that maybe it's something that somebody said, or maybe it's something that somebody did, or maybe it's a wound so deep that it's begun to shape itself in your character, and you're beginning to live that out and keep rehearsing that thing over and over in your mind. And you begin to see that there's this point or perspective that we have to kind of deal with what used to be in the past in order to move ahead to what's in the future. And in this particular story, we see somebody kind of like that. We see a guy who has been sick, or he's been paralyzed for 38 years. Now, I don't know how long he sat by that river, because it doesn't really say, but obviously when Jesus comes on the scene, he sees that he was there all along. Now in the story, it's got a good ending. We already read part of it was that Jesus healed this man, and this particular point in this passage caused a lot of trouble among the religious leaders, which you go on to read a little bit later. And it has to do with the fact that although this guy was healed on the Sabbath, it brings Jesus into direct confrontation with the Pharisees and the scribes, because it's kind of like Jesus is setting himself above the Sabbath, and they kind of got ticked off that this guy should be healed on the Sabbath, so it caused all these problems that was there. And although that's one point of the message, I'm not really where I'm at. You know, I get that. I get the fact that, yes, the meaning of the story is Jesus is confronting the religious leaders, and that, you know, this was really a question about Sabbath, but let's talk about the guy and his condition just for a minute. What do you think Jesus saw when he comes up on the calendar? I mean, Jesus was always going about doing what he's doing. He comes on the scene in the pool of Bethesda, and this is not a swimming pool. It's a it's near the sheep gate. There's this pool, and a lot of disabled people, blind, lame, it says, paralyzed, are laying around the scene. And they're there laying around because they want to be healed. And at some point in time, the waters are miraculously stirred by what they assume is an angel. And the first one in the water usually gets healed. And the rest of the guys, they're just kind of laying there. And this guy is expressing, when Jesus sees that, he watches this dynamic. He sees this guy, and he recognizes that this guy's been there a long time. Now, is there any doubt in your mind that Jesus knew who this guy was? Why would Jesus know who this guy is? You ever think for just a moment that in your own life, in your own dysfunction, in your own paralysis, that maybe you're struggling with something that you have been carrying for a long time? Now, even as seasoned Christians, how many here today would say that you've been carrying and you have carried something in your heart for a long, long time? How many of you think that you might, and this is not an issue of unforgiveness, but let's say there's an issue in your hearts for a long time. The one that you feel paralyzed with and you don't know that you can get over, and thank you for raising your hand. I think this guy's kind of in the same condition, and I think one thing that's unique is that I don't think Jesus does anything by chance. I don't believe that any action that he's ever taken has ever been done without thought. And so I'm thinking when he goes to that pool and he's answering that guy, that it's in response to the prayers that this guy has made there by the pool, and who probably went through have you ever gone through a frustrating time through those 20 some odd years or whatever it is that you've been carrying that burden, where you're thinking to yourself, God's not hearing me when I pray. And he is not responding to me. And here I am, poor sap, just laying around waiting for somebody to help me, and God doesn't care about what I'm going through. So I think this guy's probably obviously has had to have a moment like this a time or two. And yet here is Jesus specifically going to this guy. And then he goes into looking at the guy, and then he asks him a pretty rhetorical question, he sees him lying there, and he sees that he's been there, for a long time. And he asks the guy a very unique question, which I'll get to for a minute because I forgot about it. I wanted to do one more point when I was talking about the hurts that you're carrying. Maybe you're here this morning and you are hurting. And let's say there's something that's been bugging you for a long time and you're carrying it. You're trying to figure out whether or not God really sees you in the state that you're in. Did you notice that this guy's not laying around this pool by himself? It's not just he's in isolation. He's laying there with a lot of other people that are hurting just as bad as he is. One of them's going to get healed by some miraculous situation. And it gives I'm a strange person, so I look at two things. The first thing I look at is, boy, it bugs me when I'm waiting in line and somebody cuts in front of me. It bothers me when I have 15 items in my basket and somebody has 16. Isn't that weird? I'm pretty anal. So I actually count, you know, the items as they're coming out of the baskets. And I haven't got much grace for 16 item people in the 15 people line, because when I have 16 items, I go to the regular line the way it is, you know. But there's some people that just kind of, they always just see, you know, I have this saying that says, fools rush in and get all the good seats. Do you ever notice that it's right when you're trying to be kind in a parking lot and you're sitting behind somebody and you're waiting for them to get in their vehicle and you're trying to pull out and, you know, oh, you have to back up because, you know, the person needs a little bit more room to get in. And as soon as they pull out some, you know, person whips right into your parking space. And then they say something, well, I didn't see you. No, yeah, I don't see you getting in your car to move your car either. You know, I just don't like it when people, you know, cut in front of you or whatever. You know, that's my pet peeve. I don't think that's right. You know, if you're waiting in line, get in line and wait just like everybody else. Well, this part of this is going on in this situation, you know. Obviously, they're all so desperate for healing that when the waters are being stirred, no one's going after you. I don't think any of us would be either. It's like, I'm getting what I'm getting, and I'm getting what I'm getting now. The second thing that comes to my mind is that there's a lot of hurting people who are staying together. And I think sometimes when people are getting hurt and they're going through life, you tend to think that you're the only one that's going through it. And you got to recognize that there's people all over the place that are going through hurtful stuff too. Lots of people are tempted and...